Bondi Beach. Yes. Everybody knew Bondi Beach, and it was only just outside Sydney. So we hired taxis and went in groups. And we were greeted like heroes.
Charles Simpson, Reel 16.
You're never going to forget it.
I think I'm just beating the record, actually. Anyway. What happened to Belfast in Australia?
Oh, we went to refit. It had been a very long journey, and we were going to have an even longer journey to join the American fleet at Singapore. So we had been originally directed to Fremantle, where there was a huge dockyard, but we were redirected to Sydney, where we undergo a refit.
It may seem like a silly question. You've just been refitted out in England. Why did it need another refit in Sydney?
Because it had all the facilities of a naval dockyard. It was the Australian Navy's principal dockyard.
But why did the Belfast need a second refit?
Well, it had come how many thousands of miles from England to Sydney. And it was required to ensure that we were at, although we were not to engage in fighting, we were to engage in duties equivalent to wartime. So we had to be at wartime fitness, which included the machinery, and to make sure everything had to be at wartime efficiency. All fuel tanks had to be cleaned. Guns had to be made at the utmost, just in case they were required, to engage Japanese forces who had not surrendered.
In the event, I think the Belfast didn't take part in any further wartime activities. What was the purpose of remaining in the Pacific?
We were to join the American fleet to engage in any mopping up operations. Although the Japanese emperor had surrendered, millions of his soldiers in isolated islands and in positions on the coastline had not surrendered. There were stories 6 or 7 years after the war, that there were still Japanese soldiers who had not surrendered. So, although the war as such had ended, there were still positions to be attacked and rendered useless by Japanese soldiers who were still holding out. Likewise, there were hundreds of prisoners of war to be recovered and taken to places of safety. The Belfast made immediately to the island which was then called Formosa, where hundreds of British soldiers had been engaged in copper mines, where they lived under tropical conditions, in several feet of water, hewing out copper ore. And their duty was to take on board as many of these ex-prisoners of war as the ship could accommodate. So we went alongside a jetty, and to our absolute horror, there were Japanese soldiers on the jetty. Not carrying rifles, but obviously being left there for some duty which we couldn't immediately fathom. So the sight of a Japanese soldier in his uniform brought horror to my nature. And out of a opening onto the jetty emerged these prisoners of war, who were skeletons, walking skeletons. They looked terrible. They were ushered aboard with the utmost kindness, the majority having been assisted up the gangway, and they were accommodated wherever they could be, and we took them off to some place of safety. An experience no one ever forgot. They had been ill-treated. They lived in conditions of intense heat and considerable danger, very poorly fed. They then suffered what we now call inhuman treatment. And I'm sure they reminded everybody on board what the war really meant.
How long did they remain on the Belfast, in the Belfast?
After that.
What did you do with them?
We went then. I think we didn't actually engage in any gunfire, because our duties of rescuing were passive ones. But after some time, which I can only guess was 4 or 5 weeks, we went then up to Shanghai. Where we were under the directions of the American Admiral. And I think we were there more to represent the British Navy than anything else.
What happened to the prisoners of war?
We took them to places of safety. Not very long journeys. We didn't steam hundreds of miles to take them. I think they were probably only on board a couple of days until it was considered safe for them to be aided on shore. They were, of course, treated with the utmost tenderness and kindness. I think sailors would have died to protect them if that had become necessary.
What other duties did the Belfast undertake at this time?
They became humanitarian duties. For the few days that I was still on board in Shanghai, although we were part of the American force, we were partly under American command, but still partly under British command. So, although when we got alongside a jetty in Shanghai, our American liaison officers were able to go on shore, but we were not permitted to go on shore until our own authorities said we might do so.
Is that because of the
They
risk?
Considered it prudent for us to stay on board for the few days that I remained in Belfast.
And how did you come to leave the Belfast?
My appointment was terminated. I was relieved by another Lieutenant Commander E being appointed as the senior engineer.
And why was that? Was it just because
my term was ended. The normal terms of appointment for officers, on a very broad average, is 2 years. I served for 3 years and 4 months in the Belfast.
How did you feel about leaving her?
With great regret. It had been my second home for 3 years and 4 months. It had provided me with every facility that I required for living. To be in a ship is an experience that you can only feel about when you've been in it, under all the conditions that a ship experiences. You have to be them in peacetime, you have to be them when the guns are firing. And then the ship becomes something quite different to any other kind of habitation. Space is limited. Your friend is always within arm's length.
You left Belfast?
Yes.
I know you had a long naval career after that, but where did you go next?
It was considered that I should be taken, somehow or other, to Singapore, where I would be transported back to England. The transport they found for me was in the rear gun turret of a Royal Air Force bomber. So there I sat, suspended in space. For the journey to Singapore. When I got there, I was met by the naval authorities who said that I had been appointed to HMS Resource, which was a fleet repair ship. I was to be the senior engineer for the time it took for it to take passage to England. And I would remain on board until it was paid off. So, instead of going back free from responsibility, I had to act as senior engineer in a completely strange kind of ship for the weeks and weeks and weeks it took for it to slowly trudge all the way back to England. A fleet repair ship is a multi-manufacturing concern on several decks in a single ship. It is specially designed to repair anything and to manufacture anything, from a small boiler to a spade. To give you some idea, there were 37 lathes. That's single operated machines in one workshop. Now, the machinery required artificers to operate them. So, this was a very unusual ship. It had dozens and dozens of artificers on board, who had been recruited as war's only personnel from every possible source of men who could operate lathes, drilling machines, forgeries, blacksmiths, coppersmiths. They were, in fact, civilians in uniform. Because they had been working hard repairing warships for anything up to 7 years, the captain had been in command 7 years, lying alongside the jetty, of course, because it was not the ship to go to sea. Other ships come and lay aside it, pleading for this to be repaired, that to be made good. So it was a very strange ship for me to go on. I was not in the least bit familiar with what was inside the hull, and I was utterly astonished at the dozens and dozens of machinery spaces that there were enclosed within the hull. The men, the fitters and the stokers who have been most employed in the ship, you don't meet many seamen when it's tied up alongside the jetty, so most were artisans of one kind or another, had really been working overtime. So the captain and Commander E had agreed that they could relax beyond those required to actually steam the ship. So all those who had previously been on machines and not on the propelling machinery were allowed to relax. After all, you can't repair anything at all unless it's small enough to be in the ship already. So I found a ship with hundreds of engine room personnel with nothing to do except straightforward watchkeeping duties. The Commander E, prior to my arrival, had given them permission to make lead soldiers. And wherever I went in the engine room department, there were hundreds and hundreds of lead soldiers in various states of manufacture.
And what happened to the soldiers?
Well, those individuals who were making them collected them when they arrived in Portsmouth and took their shares home, I presume.
How long were you on that ship? How long were you in that ship?
From June 46 to halfway through August 46. So about 6 or 7 months.
And after that, where did you go?
After that, I was appointed to HMS Triumph, an aircraft carrier, slightly smaller than HMS Victorious, serving in the Mediterranean.
And what did the aircraft carrier do? What was its function in the Mediterranean?
By that time, we were well and truly into peacetime routine. It was a flagship. And as such, it had the privilege of more or less deciding where it would go. So we were able to pursue a normal peacetime routine of going out to sea to provide practice for the aircrew. An aircraft carrier is a super garage for aircraft. The engineer, the marine engineer's duty is to take the ship to sea to allow the pilots and observers to do their flying practice. And you have the very strange situation in which half the officers are only on board when the ship goes to sea. Because prior to arriving back in harbour after a long practice at sea, all the aircraft which are serviceable fly off and land in an aerodrome ashore. So, a great deal of the time, all the pilots and observers are ashore.
How long were you on that ship? Or in that ship?
Until April 1948. So that would have been 18 months. I was very cross indeed when the commander came and told me that a new senior engineer had been appointed. The average time being 2 years, and this being something like 18 months, my immediate inquiries was, why have I been relieved early? And he said, I've not the faintest idea, but we'll find out when he comes. The new senior engineer had been a shipmate of mine as a warrant engineer in HMS Victorious. And he had been promoted later than myself to lieutenant. But by that time, he'd become a lieutenant commander and was my relief as senior engineer. So the first question I asked him was, why have you relieved me early? And he said, I'm a submariner, by which he meant that the most of his experience after leaving the apprentices were in submarines. And he was being sent to gain experience in a normal warship.
And where did you go?
I went straight home, of course, took the leave to which I was entitled, and then I went to the best appointment I ever had. Although it was an appointment ashore, it sent its ships to sea. So, although based ashore, it was in all respects, other than in size, part of the going to sea Navy. It was called HMS Hornet, and it was a very famous combined submarine and small ship depot. Accommodation was on shore, but all the action took place at sea. They were motor torpedo boats and motor gunboats, which had become famous for attacking craft at sea with torpedoes and guns. They were super fast, very small. Now, I had a double appointment. It was a senior engineer of HMS Hornet, for which I was partly responsible for the machinery in these little craft. But my principal duty was senior engineer of what was called ACCE, A-C-X-E, which was short of the Admiralty Craft Experimental Establishment. And this particular establishment, though incorporated with HMS Hornet, was separate from it. The commander, like myself, had feet in both. Other officers were either or. The experimental establishment had the fantastic duty of trying out everything that was new, under construction or under design, suitable for these small craft. We were building the first ever aluminium hulled ship, and it was being built by a bus company in North Wales, and I used to make frequent trips to North Wales to inspect the hull and the machinery of this utterly new kind of warship. Another experiment was to manufacture the very first adjustable propeller. This was a propeller being produced for the very first time in which you could shift the blades and vary the speed of the ship with a constant engine speed by moving parts of the propeller. This was being manufactured by a motor car company. So I used to make frequent trips to the motor car company to see the progress in the very first of the adjustable propellers. Another thing, and the most important, and which has become absolutely world famous, we were installing the very first gas turbine ever in a little ship. They took an ordinary gas turbine and installed it in this little ship.
When was your next appointment? When was your next posting? Where was your next move?
My next move was to HMS Cockade, to the Korean War.
What are your memories of that time?
Very, very intense indeed. The engineer officer, of whom there was only one, had several other duties to perform. He was the damage control officer. He was the stores officer. He was the divisional officer.
I take it that this ship was
a destroyer. What's more, it was a very old destroyer. The Admiralty considered that if they were sending ships to fight a distant war, they might as well send out the old ships. So the destroyers they sent were C-class. I had manned one of them 25 years before. Cockade was worn out. It took my duties as damage control officer, store officers and engineer officers 11 hours a day, including Sundays, for 2 years to keep the ship efficient. When holes appeared in the bottom, and they did, flooding the compartments, it was my duty as the damage control officer and the stores officer to pump it out, effect what repairs I could, and keep steaming the ship. When holes appear, I, as stores officer, had had the prudence to have quick-acting cement in the stores in anticipation of damage. So, as a stores officer, I ordered the chief stores officer to release packets, sacks of quick hardening cement, and we poured these into the bilges of the compartment to stop the water entering.
What was the Cockade's role in the Korean War?
To lie off the shores of Korea, and at the captain's discretion, to fire a given number of shots from the guns. So, pretending that it was 20, I can't remember the number, the captain had the discretion to fire these all in one go, or at 10-minute intervals, or at one-hour intervals, if he felt like it. The whole purpose was to disrupt action on shore, and principally roads and railways that ran along the shoreline. So my own captain would have a bit of fun. He would determine one night that he would fire them all in one go.
Charles Simpson, Reel 17. What other duties did the cockade have in the Korean War?
None. It was to bombard. It was to bombard the coast. Oh, it had a second and most important duty, which was to follow an American aircraft carrier whenever that was desired by the American admiral. It was a duty that be called upon at very short notice. So as the engineer of the ship, the engine department had to be at a moment's notice almost to proceed from slow speed to maximum speed. Every part of the compartment had to be ready, as it were, to go at 30 knots. When we went from very slow speed to a very high speed, as quickly as we could, it had the effect of slightly damaging the propellers, which, when we went into refit, prolonged the refit. So it had the benefit of, for the rest of the ship's company, of allowing us to stay longer in the dockyard than would be otherwise the case.
Do you have any other memories about your time in the Korean War?
Yes. We went into a Japanese dockyard for refit and partial repair. This was undertaken later on in Singapore. But we had, during those 2 years, we had times in harbour, but this was in Sasebo, in southern Japan. And they included normal shore leave. And it was possible in the time available to arrange visits to other parts of Japan.